conflict with each other. So that's another approach. A conversation with Frank into Foxtrot, Foxtrot is worth a try. Really getting a copy of, like Steve said, really read it yourself. You're going to find out it's not written in very clear English, and you're going to find conflicting chapters. And when you bring that to their attention, they got all kinds of ways of weasel wording how the conflicting chapters don't...
Repeater, time out.
How the conflicting chapters don't really conflict. They got all kinds of weasel ways of wording that. So it looks to me like Baldwin is not the place that's friendly for ham radio right now, but that's got to change. KA2GEF, K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Well, to be honest with you, Dick, I did do that. I looked it up because on the summons it said, what was it, Article 86, Section 9-8. And I read 9-8 at 86, and it had nothing to do with antennas. It was about a chimney that is attached to the house, and after the house is built, like if I were to put a stove in, a coal bin stove, right, or a wood stove, and I needed an external antenna, and not hook it up to my own antenna, that's what it dealt with, and I brought that up to their attention, and the guy says, well, he probably used the wrong code. I said, well, show me where it says I can't have an antenna.
Another thing you got to worry about, not only the conflicting of the chapters, but don't let them call your piece of pipe a tower. It is an antenna support structure. Antenna support structure. I'll allow you to come up with the three-letter abbreviation for that if you want to, as long as you remember it. It's not a radio tower. It's a piece of pipe. It's an antenna support structure. The word tower has some very specific definitions by the National Association of Broadcasters, the Federal Communications Commission. The real organizations that really define things have a definition for what is a radio tower, like the thing that's used for AM broadcasts, where you actually light up the structure with radio signal. What you've got is an antenna support structure. They can try to call it a tower. You can attack him on that one. Back to you, Bob. K2RIW.
Oh, they already brought that one up. He says it's a tower. I said, no, it's not a tower. A tower normally has 3 to 4 legs, and I can climb a tower. I used to be able to climb a tower. This is a pipe, and if I grease it, no one's going to climb it. And it was irritating. Believe me, it was very irritating. They push your buttons like there's no tomorrow. And really, an antenna mag mount on my air conditioner is $200? That is ridiculous by any sort of means. Back to you, Dick.
Bob, do you have reason to believe that other people in your community have an aerial television receiving antenna on the house? Do you have reason to believe that your reading of the zoning law is such that a television receiving antenna has no restrictions? Do you at least stand a chance on that one? Is there anything in your community that allows an ordinary television receiving antenna? If so, I think there's all kinds of ways you can work with that. Back to you, Bob.
Okay. He never said anything about my... I have an old satellite dish from DirecTV that I haven't had for about 8 years. It's still up there, right in the middle of my roof. Didn't say anything about that, because that's a receiving antenna. And he says, we don't have any problems with receiving TV antennas, because all my neighbors have antennas, and they don't use them. They just, no one's taking them down. You know, once it's up there, that's it. When it falls, it falls. I don't have one. I got cable. But as far as he's concerned, that 220 antenna is going to be my TV antenna for a public service.
You seem to have stopped in the middle of a sentence. Did you stop transmitting intentionally, Bob?
No, I was going to say something else, and then I'm getting upset over this, because every time I think about it, and this guy, I call him up, he says, you have to make an appointment to speak to him. You can't speak to him on the phone. You have to come in and speak to him. What, so he can tell me what I'm not allowed to do, and then go home, and then fill out the papers? I tell you, it's frustrating. Everybody around here has antennas on their house. No one takes them down. You know, I know they all have cable, because I talk to them and say, oh, my cable's out. Oh, really? Why don't you watch TV with your antenna? Oh, no, that's just up there. I never took it down. So now what I'm going to do, if there's anyone in the club, I am a dual amputee. I cannot climb anymore. I need someone, if they can take... If they can take down the mast for me, if I... Because I don't want to pay $200 for it. 220 and 10 I'm not even using. You know, if they don't believe it. So, I'd like to know if there's anyone who can help me out in that respect. And just bring down the pipe. All the brackets in the walls, I don't care about. They can stay there. It's not going to affect the house. But that's one way of getting you out of Nassau County. By pushing you out. For every little antenna you got, it's $200. That's ridiculous. All right, back to you, Dick. KA2G, calming down.
Comment.
What have they done as far as real legal procedures so far? Have they said that something must take place by such and such date, or that there's going to be a court hearing? From what you know, what do you believe is their next step? Over to you, Bob.
Yeah, station with a comment. I recognize you. Yeah, he did say I have 15 days to take down the antennas or go to court or pay the $200 and have it all permitted. Station with a comment, pick it up. Oh, back to you, Dick. You pick it up.
I have a comment to Dick M2EO.
I think it's M2XJN. Go ahead, Wes. Who's the first person who said comment?
That was KG2PPF. I was saying maybe in the next week or so, I was going out that way. I may be able to help either take down the towers or hang a flag up there or try to remedy the situation somehow, if I could be of help.
That's an attractive offer, Matt. Bob, maybe you and Matt should get together. Bob, that was Kilo Delta 2 Papa Papa Foxtrot, Matt, who's making that offer. KA2GEF, K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Comment, M2EO.
Stand by, Rich, I heard you. Bob, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, Matt. The name here is Bob Baker, Ocean Baker. Yeah, I'm in Baldwin, and all it is a mask, and I have Kindorf on the side. All you have to do is release the Kindorf slowly and bring down the pipe, and that's it. I would appreciate it. And we'll talk. I'll give you my number if you want to take it now over the air. If not, give me email. This is KA2GEF at gmail.com.
Matt, see if Matt needs any fill, then we'll go over to Erica and KD2 PPF. Go ahead, Matt.
Of Okay, great. I think I got KA2GES at gmail.com. Is that correct?
Golf Echo Foxtrot at gmail.com. Back to you, Matt.
Okay, great. Got it. Yeah, I'll try to set some up in a week or after that. We can exchange numbers. Over. Or I'll send you an email, too.
N2EO, go ahead with your comment.
Okay, Dick. I don't know if you've ever heard of the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act. That was signed by George H. Bush, the first Bush, and they created lawyers. They don't charge the staff lawyers, the federal government, to enforce laws affecting disabled people. You should contact them.
Bob, do you need some fill on that? KA2GES, go right ahead.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of the Disabilities Act, and that's my last resort. I'd rather try not to throw that in, but in my position, yeah, I might have to. Because I do enjoy the radio, and I do enjoy the idea of having the freedom of listening to other people and talking, and it's what I do now. It used to be my career, and now it's my hobby again.
One thing I'm going to suggest to you, Bob, is try not to get upset by what that crazy little tin god of a guy, the instructor who came to your house. He's a guy who is overly impressed with his power, if you know what I mean. He doesn't have anywhere near as much power as he makes it sound. And they make it sound to you that if you don't comply with every one of their rules within 15 years, they're going to bring, the hammers of hell down on you. They make it sound that way. It ain't anywhere near that bad. Let's see what Eric's got to say on all of the above. KE2EJ, K2REW, go ahead, Eric.
K2REW, K2EJ. If you are an ALL member, you can call up the headquarters, and they actually have a whole group of people who help folks just like Bob out. So, you know, if you don't get hold of Frank Fallon, you might just call ARRL and they will in turn get him in touch with you instead of the other way around. They are pretty helpful in terms of that kind of stuff. So, you might give them a call tomorrow and say, hey, I've got a problem.
Back to you, Bob, for any comment on that.
Excellent idea. Okay, I'm going to do that tomorrow because all this guy does is like to, and he wouldn't talk to me. He was in my yard and would not talk to me and about what he's, all the complaints. And that's what irritated me. And then his boss just puts me off and puts me off. I'll call you back. I'll call you back. And then he gives me to another guy. I'll call you back. You know, everybody's going to call me back. Meanwhile, I'm running out of days. But I'm going to try that. I thank you, Eric. I thank you, Matt. I look forward to talking to you. And Rich and Dick, I thank you very much for taking up the time with my problems. Thank you, KA2GES.
Out of curiosity, Bob, what kicked this whole situation off? Was it a neighbor that filed a complaint? What brought a inspector into your yard in the first place, from your knowledge, Bob, go ahead.
My neighbor, because I took down my old stockade fence, and this way I could see his new fiberglass white fence. He didn't like the idea. It was on my land. I could take down my old fence. I got tired. It was 20 years old, Dick, and the fence, I was getting tired of repairing it. So when he put up a brand new fence, I took mine down. Now I have a nice white fence on that side. It's 170 feet long. Hey, it's nice. I thanked him. And after that, he didn't particularly care for it.
Now, one of the philosophies I've adjusted to and not everyone's going to agree with me on this one. When it comes to getting along with your neighbors and when it comes to getting along with your local government and zoning board, make believe that we amateurs are second-class citizens. I know that that doesn't go down easily. We got to be super friendly with them and super diplomatic and don't do anything to anger anybody because by way of the legal procedures, they can make your life kind of miserable. You got to stay friendly with your neighbors if you're a ham radio operator. As I said, not everyone's ever going to agree with that, on that one. Let me drop. I know a number of prominent amateur radio operators on Long Island who have said to their neighbors, yes, you've got television interference. Yes, I've got antennas on my property that you think is an eyesore. But I have the federal government's right to do that. I have this FCC license. I passed their exam. Therefore, you don't have any power over me to adjust what I'm doing. I'm going to have my ham radio antennas, and I'm going to go on the air and transmit. And if your television set is defective and picks up television interference, that's your problem. You say words like that, and you think you've got that power, boy, you're going to create a huge problem. I know of a couple of specific amateurs who have said words like that. And 5 years later, and $20,000 in legal fees later, they got an answer that they were very unhappy with. You got to try to stay friendly with your neighbors if you're a ham radio operator. It's not easy. You got to do ridiculous things to stay neighbors, to stay friendly. That's an opinion. KQRIW listening for people who are going to disagree with me.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Dick. It wasn't that. It was strictly the fence. He didn't like the idea that when he put up a fence, that I took my old one down. He even that day called the police department, the first precinct, and told them that I removed my old fence. And the cop says, and what do you want me to do? And the cop says, you took down your old fence? I said, yeah. What's wrong with that? His is much nicer than my old wooden one. I got tired of fixing it. His is nice. The cop says, there's nothing I can do, man. And he told him, there's nothing he can do. And that's what started it. He called the cops on me. And everybody else in this neighborhood I have done favors for when I could. But now, lately, I just make phone calls.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Their family, but this guy, nothing. He cut a tree down on his side and dropped all the tree limbs on my new driveway. And all I said is, could you kindly pick it up? He says, I'll do it when I want to. This is the kind of guy he is. So, that's my statement with that. I try to be a nice guy. I am a nice guy. But please, don't tread on me.
Okay, I've got the picture. Good luck with all of the above. I hope some of those phone calls will make some improvement on this, Bob. Don't give up. They don't have quite as much power over you as they've led you to believe. They lead you to believe that in 15 days they're going to evict you from your own house. I mean, they'll make it sound like that. They don't have anywhere near that amount of power. So that deadline they've given you, that date they've given you, it's not as hard a deadline as you think, in my opinion. I might be wrong. Okay, we're going to go to the next person. Next person who had a question was Rich, N2EO. Go ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. So on, you let the ID go to. N2EO. Similar question to Bob's. As you know, probably listen, I'm moving to Florida. Soon as this house sells, I'm gone. I will still stay a Limark member and come into Echo Link. There is no zoning board where I'm going. I made sure of that. There are no HOAs. I believe that as a building inspector, you think I'll run into a problem?
I don't think we can stand a chance of answering that question for you, Rich, because as we discovered tonight with Bob, and as I've discovered with dealing with my town and various other people dealing with their towns, each individual town has their own group of people who have their own ideas as to what they will allow, whether or not it's an antenna, whether or not it's an antenna support structure, whether or not it creates television interference, whether or not it creates radio frequency biohazard, whether or not it's a physical eyesore, whether or not you're allowed to be 8 inches above a existing structure, whether you're allowed to be 15 feet, whether you're allowed to be 35 feet total. They've all got their own individual crazy rules. Let me drop. I did the same checking you did. I found out that there was no specific zoning law in Huntington Town at the time that I purchased my house. And so therefore I thought moving in and putting up an antenna, no problem. However, between the time that I went to contract and the time that I moved in, they did create some kind of a loosely defined law that they applied against me. And so whether or not I had already gone to contract and whether or not it was an ex post facto situation, it got complicated. And through a very left-handed situation, 5 years later, the situation finally got settled in my case. But the zoning law and checking on it, you may get a perfectly good answer today. And by the time you go to contract and move in, will the situation be the same? The zoning people themselves, when you get a brand new people of zoning officials that are elected next year, they can set up an entirely different set of rules. So without you having somebody, let me drop. The only way you're going to get a partial answer is if there's somebody who is very good, legally savvy person in that community who can tell you what's really going on. Unless you can find that person, you're not going to get an answer. And no matter what answer you got for an adjacent town, it doesn't necessarily apply to that town on that particular street, and whether or not you're in the incorporated village or in the outside of the incorporated village, if you know what I mean. So there is no exact answer that any of us could give you. You have to find out what exists on that particular piece of property today and try to find out what you think is going to exist 6 months from now when you move in. I know that's not the answer you want to hear, but the Homeowners Association and zoning boards and zoning boards of appeal, boy, they've got some huge differences on communities that are 5 miles apart on Long Island. Huge differences. N2EO, K2LIW.
K2 Bravo Zulu with a comment.
Bravo Zulu, go right ahead. You start off with your full call and your name.
The full call is Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. The name is Rich. And I think I'm finally hitting the Selden machine with a vertical dipole on top of a 10-foot pole that I just bought at PVC at last night at Home Depot. Anyway, my suggestion is there are people who, for a living, help people who are building homes with getting their codes up to snuff. They're independent people, and I would seek one of those out because, you know, I don't think they're politically connected this way or that. You may have to pay a little fee. Whoops, got some heat problems. Yeah, I may have to pay a little piece for their advice, but for those independent code people who help your town hall might be worth it.
Your new antenna through the Selden machine is sounding good, Bob. It's working like a charm, that new antenna through the Selden machine. Okay, these zoning people who you're talking to us about, how does Rich get a hold of them? And Rich, it looks to me like the answer that Bob got is also applicable to you. Even though you may not currently be a ARRL member, you don't have to tell them that. Do call up ARRL and ask them your particular question for that particular community. Be able to name the town and the county when you go to ARRL, and they might be able to give you an answer. But Rich, how can the other Rich, N2EO, get a hold of the group of people that you're discussing? November 2, Bravo Zulu, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich, number 2.
Yeah, Dick, it's Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. And they're all over Google. You know, it'd be something that used to be in the yellow pages. But just Google, you know, what you can on it. I mean, I could do it while you're talking and find out, but they're very easy to find. I know a woman up here who does it, and she's very successful with it. They're very easy to find. W2BZ.
Okay, W2BZ, you're saying they are easy to find. They have got the answer. What search word would you use with Google to find this particular group of people? How do I identify this group of people? Over to you, Rich number two.
I would say that you Google help with code compliance, building code compliance, and a whole bunch of independents who are in the business to do just that, to facilitate, the builder with town, town hall building department. And they can advise you. I know somebody did it with a deck or whatever it was.
Okay, thank you. That sounds like good information, Rich. I see if Rich number one, N2EA, we need any fill on that. So building code compliance is one of the search sets of words that'll help you find these people that can help. And so them plus ARRL, knowing the exact community and the county that you're going to, you'll be able to find out more about what are the antenna restrictions. N2EO, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. I'm just going to put up a 2 meter 440 vertical and my dipoles that I'm here. The reason I don't want anything big, I can't maintain it. As Bob said, I am also a double amputee. So I can't maintain it myself. I don't want it. I think what I'm going to do tonight is send an email to the Bayport Amateur Radio Society. Good place to start.
If there really is such a situation, yes. In other words, you have found out that there is a ham radio group of people in that community with that name. You've already discovered that, Rich. Go ahead.
I have. They got a website.
Okay. So if they've lived in the community for more than a couple of months, they've got to have more answers than many other groups of people. So sounds to me like you've got three groups now. So there's a code compliance group, ARRL, plus the ham radio group in that town. You follow through on all that, you're going to get an answer. But there's no other way that we up here can tell you what you're going to run into down there, because each homeowner association and each zoning board of appeals, they've all got their crazy rules, and sometimes they're extremely different on two communities side by side. Okay, the next person on the list was Matt. Hope we haven't put him to sleep. Kilo Delta 2, Papa Foxtrot, I think it is. K2RAW. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Dick. Thanks. I just had a quick question about DMR. I guess it's one of the newest things. Is there an easy place to find out information about, color codes, talk groups? Is there a one-stop shop to find out about DMR? That's pretty much my question.
Yeah, that's a darn good question. KE2EJ, if he's on frequency, I think he can recommend a number of people who have gone down that road and solved some of those problems. KE2EJ, K2RW, go ahead, Eric. Do we have a person with DMR knowledge on the air tonight? If so, give me your call letters right now, K2RW. I know that one of the people locally, KA2YHY, Kilo Alpha 2 Yankee Hotel Yankee, he has solved a lot of problems for a lot of people. So he's somebody to seek out. Eric, KE2EJ, has a lot of knowledge on the subject. There's one or two more. So if you get a hold of them, I think they can help an awful lot. I think even the WA2CDL, I think WA2CDL, another guy who, Andy, can help quite a bit. But do you need to fill in any of those frequencies, any of those call letters, Matt? KD2, Papa Papa Foxtrot, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW. Yeah, thanks. You know, I knew for some reason tonight I asked all the impossible questions, and it's something in the works. I see it's not hard, it's not easy, but yet I'll do it somehow. Let's get back to the net because I know it's going to be really interesting tonight. And thanks, guys.
Now, hey, Matt, what made you think the net's going to be very interesting tonight? What made you say that, Matt? I'd like to find out what it is that we're doing that's so interesting. You got it, Matt.
Because I think every Sunday night, it pretty much goes on for at least 4 hours, and it's, like, totally interesting, the different reports, and I love it. You know, it's better than TV. You know, you actually get more information here than you do on the television, and, a lot of smart guys in this net. I really like it a lot, and I'm having fun with you guys. Thanks, guys.
Here, KD2PIG.
PIG and PPF? Fantastic. What a testimonial. We pay for testimonials like that. The check is in the mail, Matt. Very good. Okay, we've gone down the list of everybody who checked in who had a question or a comment tonight. And so, just about the right time to go over to science and physics report from Dr. Roy, KD2, AC2, Golf Sierra. So, Roy, take it away. AC2GS, K2RIW. By the way, we have individual net control operators. Your next net control operator is Dr. Roy. You got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick, and hello to everyone. And once again, I want to remind everyone that if they have any topics that they want discussed or questions they want answered, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, at the end of this, you could go to a website, roy.ac2gs.com, and I will have links to many of the articles that I am alluding to during this little presentation. Let me drop. Before I start, though, I might as well help Matt out a little bit. There's an organization called DMR Mark, and they have a website, www.dmr-marc.net, and it has a lot of information on DMR technology. And there's a little manual that's floating around on the Internet. If you just Google for DMR manual, it says it has a $2 price tag, but it's for free. And it has a very good summary of DMR technology, of code plugs, of color codes, of zones and such.
I appreciate that.
Good, Matt. Okay, I have a bunch of news stories. I'll do it one at a time. If anyone has any questions or comments about it, feel free to hit the push-to-talk button, and we'll talk about it for a while. Let me drop. Okay, first up is for you guys who are very impressed with yourself that you've fabricated your own circuit boards or even that you somehow got a wave soldering device to do soldering of an entire printed circuit board. There's a young kid who's grabbed the gold ring. That is a 17-year-old radio amateur in New Jersey. Call sign is KD2ENL. First name is Sam. He is building his own integrated circuit fabrication in his garage. He's fabricated a few discrete semiconductors, and his long-term plan is that he wants to fabricate a kind of historic chip. The Intel had a 4004 chip that predates microcomputers. It has about 2,000 discrete solid-state devices on it, and he's planning to fabricate it by hand in his garage. So talk about a developing ham out there.
P2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Bravo Zulu.
This is very close to something I wanted to make a comment on. Another young man, his name is Louis Rossman, R-O-S-S-M-A-N-N, and he's a benchman. He fixes electronics, and he just went over 400,000 subscribers on YouTube. He's a little cocky, but he's brilliant, and he explains everything he does and how he does it, and even the tools he uses. I don't know if that's quite germane to what you're saying, but again, it's Louis Rossman, R-O-S-S-M-A-N-N. He's a brilliant diagnostician.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube is an incredibly great source for all kinds of very bright, informative people. This young man who's doing the integrated circuit fabrication, I don't believe has a channel on YouTube, but the way that he first got into this part of the hobby was he listened to someone else's YouTube. There's a woman out there called Jerry Ellsworth. You probably have heard of her. She became a ham a few years ago. I think her call sign is AI6TK, and she's one of those people who are, they call themselves makers. They make little gadgets and such. She built her own software-defined radio from scratch, from components, a few years ago. And so she fabricated some integrated circuits, and he saw it on YouTube, and he decided, gee, I guess I could do that as well. So it's sort of amazing what's out there.
But a guy building his own microprocessor, wow. I mean, back in the days when we had to build everything with tubes and resistors and capacitors, vacuum tubes, we really called that homebrew. When you build your own microprocessor, is that still called homebrew, or do you, Roy?
At the very least, according to the description of how he's working it, it's garage brew. So, yeah, it's homebrew. That's pretty good. You know, being able to configure, say, 2,000 different discrete devices, which is how you kind of have to build them for 04. It really was the precursor to microcomputers. I think it was only used as a calculator because it was very limited. The registry had the register had only 4 bits that it could hold at one time. So it made for a decent calculator at the dawn of this great electronics boom that we've been watching. It went from the 4004 to the 8008, and finally the 8080 that gave us the first group of microcomputers. So it's sort of fascinating on a historical basis that he decided on building a 4004. You know, he could have built, there's a lot of integrated circuits that people still use to this very day. There's the 555 timer chip, there's phase lock loop chips, but I think he chose a good one if he can do 2,000 different discrete devices.
Bravo Zulu with a comment.
I think Eric was first.
Okay. I just want to correct you on one thing. 8008 is actually the first really good microprocessor that Intel made. The 4004 was actually used for, it's actually used in a lot of fixed hardware, you know, performing fixed instructions. But the 8008 came out, I think it was 6 months later or 8 months later, and it actually had an index register and two accumulators, and I hate Intel stuff because they do their addressing backwards. I'm more a PDP or Motorola fan, which opcode first and addresses in the right order on the end. The 80 or the 8080. Took a while before that came around.
I agree with you, Eric. The 4004 was used as calculators and other things. 8008 was in a few microcomputers before the Altair model really took off with the design. Those two microcomputers that used the 8008 never went anywhere. Once Intel came out with the 8080, the microcomputer revolution started. And I agree with you. I liked Motorola and the way that they did the opcode, but, you know, apparently inherited it all. So, yeah, you know, I mean, I was not an IBM PC person either. I loved my Amiga. I thought it was ran rings around it, but every so often the best doesn't win, so you settle for what wins.
52 Bravo Zulu.
It's Bravo Zulu.
I always wondered why Steve Wozniak chose the Motorola 6502, which I thought it was because it did better graphics. And if you read his autobiography, that's not why at all. He chose it because it was cheaper than any of the other Intels.
I wasn't Motorola either. Rockwell.
Probably in addition, Wozniak, he was a great engineer. I assume he's still a great engineer. It's a shame he hasn't engineered anything lately.
The last thing he tried was a universal remote that really didn't go anywhere. And no, he hasn't tried anything in a while. His brilliance was in simplifying circuits so things would move faster. And in fact, he gave his talk, he introduced the Apple One at, I think it was the San Mateo Homebrew Radio Corp.
Yeah, he was very clever at cutting corners and getting things to work better than they theoretically should by cutting those little corners. He's a very bright guy. I guess he's just clipping his stock options at this point. You know, sometimes too much money kind of slows you down a bit.
Yeah, he's also in a way lost to general history. You know, Steve Jobs was the design, you know, he was the design guy. But it was, you know, Wozniak that made these things work, really work. And then when it got too big, Jobs brought in other people. But yes, he brilliance again was to simplify everything just to make it more efficient, use less energy, and have things move faster.
Yeah, in my humble opinion, Steve Jobs was a great manager, was an excellent self-promoter. I didn't think he particularly was technically that adept. I think Wozniak was the technical brains of the duo. It suited Steve Wozniak to be in the back room soldering while Steve Jobs sold the product.
That's exactly right. Steve Jobs, however, I think it was an iPad, Eric might know, or an iPhone, that he would not let, you know, he didn't send to Steve Wozniak. So Steve had to, you know, go online at Circuit City or whatever it was back then, stand online to get whatever new great product was coming out. That was sort of dissed from, that was a disrespect from Steve Jobs to Wozniak.
Well, the story is that Steve Jobs was a brilliant businessman, but a real pain in the ass to work for. So I could perfectly understand that. He was probably not someone you would invite to a cocktail party. But if you wanted to invest in someone, he probably is the guy to buy a stock in.
Yes, and I also think ham radio operators do not get enough credit for being the group of people that created the microprocessor, microcomputer business that turned out, you know, we call them PCs or whatever now. It was all ham radio operators. Roberts and Felsenstein and everybody. They're all ham radio, and Wozniak, all ham radio operators. W2BZ.
Well, what can I tell you? Life isn't fair. You can go all the way back to Edwin Armstrong, who got a really, really awful deal and ended up doing a gainer out of a window because of it.
Sarnoff took all the credit, and what brought Sarnoff to fame was receiving the SOS from the Titanic.
once again, he was a great promoter and a great businessman. As far as technology, yeah. But unfortunately, those are the guys who make the biggest noise and make the biggest paycheck. Again, life isn't fair. But, you know, as far as Edward Armstrong, it wasn't just the other guy. It was DeForest, Lee DeForest, who also horned in on Armstrong's money.
I know. I'm just very proud to be a member of the ham radio society, because, you know, most of them, I'm not an engineer nor a scientist, but you guys are. And as a group, we started most of what is now the world of consumer electronics and everything else.
AC2GS. I agree with you entirely. Although, depending upon how you want to count us, we're not dwindling, we're growing. Latest statistics on the Federal Communications Commission has amateur radio licenses as high as 750,000 people. Now, a lot of them are technicians that just have a Baofeng and are pretty much interested in just having a backup frequency. But the number of licensed amateur radio operators in the United States is the largest it's ever been. So there's some hope in the old war horse.
Well, I thought, and I'm sorry if I'm co-opting this, but I you know, the magic is gone, though. I got into ham radio when I saw my cousin who built even the chassis, punched the holes in the chassis for the components. When he was talking to Switzerland when I was 9 or 10 years old, you know, from his attic, that magic, I think, because of the internet is gone. So I would think, I'm glad to hear that the numbers are growing.
Well, I'm hoping that young people like Sam, the 17-year-old ham that's building, fabricating integrated circuits, is going to bring some of the magic back. I think there's always a little bit of the magic to go around. You just have to look for it.
QSL on that. I guess the only thing to be an electronic, if you're into electronics and you wanted to play with stuff, even if you did that at work, electronics, it was only ham radio back then, before computers. So it was a fascinating discussion. And I'm glad, you know, I know the tests had to be dumbed down, you know, and I'm pretty sure the manufacturers put the pressure.
One could say that the hobby needed a little bit kick in the backside to speed it up. I don't have any problem with exams being a little bit easier. I think all you really should have to show is an interest, a motivation to point yourself in the right direction. You could look stuff after you get your license. That, you know, that happens a lot. Anyway, let me move on to my next topic. It was good to hear you, BZ, and I hope you have time for the other stories. A long, long time ago, when Science Talk just began, we talked about LIGO, the gravity wave detector, and how it detected two neutron stars that collided. It was first of its kind, and it left... Fortunately, more questions than it solved, which was what was left when those two neutron stars collided with each other. Well, there's been a paper published recently, and the people in the know have kind of combed over the data, and they're basing their opinion by the fact that neutron stars are very heavy X-ray emitters, and the X-ray emissions after the collisions were far lower than they would suspect if the collision had caused a neutron star to be formed out of the two original. So they're believing that it's a black hole, which is very interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is that it's damn small for a black hole. The predicted mass of those two neutron stars is only about 2.7 solar masses, which is damn minuscule. Most black holes that we know of are 5 or 6 solar masses. So the smallest black hole known to man is probably the result of that neutron collision. Now, Dick, I know you want to talk about neutron stars, right?
Yes, I do, and I mailed you some of my thoughts on that exact subject. I think the estimation was that this is, what, 2.5 or 2.7 solar masses, and they used to think that you take at least 3 solar masses to make a black hole. As a neutron star gets heavier and heavier, the escape velocity at the surface becomes higher and higher, and so it approaches the speed of light. As you put enough mass into the neutron star so that the escape velocity at the surface is the speed of light, we call that a black hole. And no longer does any light escape from it anymore. And it was a neutron star right up to that point, and now you've added a little bit more mass, and you've now got this Schwarzschild radius or event horizon beyond the surface, and we call it a black hole. That doesn't mean that all the neutrons inside, that all of the mass has shrunk down to a singularity. It seems like everybody wants to believe that a black hole, all the material shrinks down to a zero dimension in the center as a singularity. Let me drop. And I'm having a lot of trouble with that, because two of the most sacred laws in the laws of physics is that you must conserve angular momentum, you must conserve momentum, linear momentum, you must conserve thermokinetic energy. In other words, energy cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in form. So you had a certain amount of mass, you've added a little bit more mass to this thing, it's not suddenly going to convert to something that different, that rapidly, in my opinion. I think inside of a black hole, the material does have a distribution. It's not all squeezed down to zero dimension in a singularity, because zero dimension, if you go to the laws that define rotation, angular momentum, it's a function of diameter of the elements and square of the diameter plus their mass, times their mass of the individual portions of something you want to know the moment of inertia. Well, something that has zero dimension is by definition going to have zero angular momentum. So you can't conserve angular momentum by having a singularity. You also can't conserve thermokinetic energy, because as you approach these extremely high temperatures that exist inside of a neutron star or inside of a black hole, the individual particles, temperature really is average kinetic energy. If the average kinetic energy is that big a number, then the individual speed of the particles is close to the speed of light. How can you have particles that go through a zero dimension and yet move at the speed of light? So you can't easily conserve thermal kinetic energy. You can't easily conserve angular momentum. Therefore, I'm of the opinion that a black hole, particularly something that's right at the threshold of a black hole, does not have a singularity on the inside. And once you accept that, let me drop. We now have 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 stars per average galaxy, and 10 to the 11 galaxies. All of that material at one time was in one spot before the Big Bang, 10 to the 22 and 10 to the 23 solar masses. The super big black hole, I call it, before the Big Bang. And if that was not a singularity, and I think it was not, the material really had a distribution, then you don't need that period of inflation they keep talking about. That period of inflation, which means in a fraction of a second, all the material moved out at way beyond warp 8. I'm having trouble believing that. It's sort of like the epicycles you used to have with the Ptolemaic solar system. When you used to think that the Earth was the center of everything, to explain the retrograde motion when you're looking at the planet of Jupiter or Saturn, you have to come up with this crazy set of rules called epicycles. Well, when it comes up with something that's that hokey, you eventually find out it really doesn't exist. And so this period of inflation where everything's expanding at warp 12, I'm having trouble accepting that. Those are some of my opinions on this subject, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of different opinions about interesting things. I too have problems with, I have problems with affinities. I have problems with point masses. I have problems with, because point masses give you weird things like infinite charge, infinite density, infinite this, infinite that, and it doesn't quite make sense to me personally, but Stephen Hawking is the go-to guy who came up with the idea of looking at all as singularities, and they've been doing a lot of work on singularities. But let me discuss neutron stars first, because I had the same sort of sense that you had. Let me drop. Most astronomical things, as you increase their mass, they tend to increase in size, for the most part. If you take a planet and double its mass, usually it's going to be bigger than before. And even with most stars, for all intents and purposes, they're bigger than before. That isn't true with neutron stars. Neutron stars are a little bit strange. Now, I'm sure everyone has heard the story that if you take a teaspoon from a neutron star, a level teaspoon of whatever that stuff that's made of, it's 10 million tons. So it's very massive. It's very dense. And the thing that makes it dense is that most atoms, I think last week we talked about fermions and bosons, and electrons, protons, and neutrons are fermions. They don't like to get very close together. So there's something called a degenerative electron pressure that holds atoms apart and keeps them the atoms. You have to defeat that with an incredible force of gravity. Let me drop. So if you increase the gravity a great deal, you override the electron degeneracy pressure that's pulling it apart, and everything collapses in on itself into neutrons. The electrons and the protons combine, neutrinos fly out, and it's one big ball of neutrons that are squeezed together using something called neutron degeneracy pressure, and that's the force of neutrons that want to stay separate. So that's what a neutron star is. If you add more mass to a neutron star, it actually shrinks in size because of the gravitational force acting against the neutron degeneracy pressure. So what I was thinking, exactly what you were thinking, Dick, you could just feed the neutron star until it peaks into a black hole and pretty much think that you've got a black hole that's really a neutron star. Let me drop. Unfortunately, there exists one really bad fact about how the models have been designed and people think behavior works with neutron stars, and that's long before you get to that point where the escape velocity is the speed of light, the neutron degeneracy becomes unstable. And there's no easy way of coaxing a heavy object into being a black hole. Usually, almost every black hole that we can conceive of has to be born in an explosion. So that's why a supernova will kind of blow off a lot of the gas, and its core will be left as a black hole if it's massive enough. Or collisions of neutron stars can become black holes. But there's no simple, easy way. A lot of other, unfortunately, complicating forces that cause big explosions before you get that black hole, which leave a bigger mystery of what the heck that black hole is behind the horizon. Let me drop. So that's my problem with a neutron star becoming a black hole. It's not as gradual as I would like it to be, because I could easily see, if it was gradual, that you'd have a neutron star hiding inside of a black hole, and it has nothing particularly to do with the singularity. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
Roy, how much evidence is there about this neutron degeneracy, that if you add more mass to a neutron star, that the diameter goes down? Some neutron stars that are rotating really become pulsars. And yes, some of these pulsars have had sort of an earthquake where they settle to a slightly smaller diameter, and all of a sudden their rotational velocity changes. But is there a whole lot of evidence other than that about this neutron density. I mean, somebody may have come up with a neutron degeneracy. People may have come up with a great theory, but has it really been confirmed? And are we talking about a 10% change, or are we talking about a 90% change in size versus mass? Over to you, Roy.
Unfortunately, a lot of this is basically theoretical physics, because